Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is repeat visit by backgammon expert Bob Wachtel. Recently, he was on the air discussing his book, In the Game Until the End, Winning in Ace Point Endgames. And we didn't get through all our questions, so Bob graciously agreed to come on back. So, Bob Wachtel, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Richard.
We spoke about the Cavendish West, which is a backgammon bridge and gin club in right outside of Los Angeles.
Was.
And one of the very colorful characters who hung out there was Gabby Horowitz. Do you remember Gabby, Bob, and what do you remember about him?
How many hours do you have?
I agree. So what are some of your favorite Gabby stories?
Well, in the late 70s and early 80s, there were, especially in Los Angeles, there were a bunch of, there was a cheating culture. And Gabby Horowitz was by far the most ostentatious and exhibitionistic of these cheaters. He was an Israeli kid who'd grown up on the streets of Tel Aviv playing whatever, hustle they had there, three card Monty or whatever he was doing.
Probably a pickpocket.
Yeah, that's probably exactly right. And, when I met him in LA, he was a kind of oily character. He was like swarthy, like Middle Eastern swarthy, but like really looked like a late 70s gigolo. Is a skinny and fairly tall guy. He wore open shirts, like V-neck shirts, show off his tan and his chest or whatever. And he was extremely narcissistic too. While explaining to you how great he was, he would caress himself. It was actually really remarkable, but he had such, he had a sensual love for himself that he actually would be feeling himself up while he was talking to you.
But, I don't remember that, but okay. I believe you. I don't remember that though.
But, Gabby's, most cheaters do their best to remain under the radar, and they want to ply their trade and make money. And if people know what they're doing, that's the end of their income. But Gabby was entirely the opposite. He was extremely proud of his, prowess at cheating. I once saw him, we were in the Bahamas, and he'd found some, woman who played backgammon. At the time, lots of people played backgammon, and they would play for money. And they were sitting outside in a cafe, open air cafe, and he saw me. I was walking by, and he sort of motioned to me, and so I started watching. And he made a point of cheating this woman on every single roll, which is almost impossible to do. He had different techniques. Some were sleight of hand, but his favorite thing to do, which he did with her all the time, was to just, it is sleight of hand to some degree, but he would, wait until she looked away for a second and then rearrange the checkers on the board. And then when she came back, she was like, might have realized that, well, this doesn't quite look right, but he made a point of doing it on every single roll of the game. And there were like, 20 or 30 rolls of the game, like every single time. He never made one legal play or let her have any chance in any game. And he gammoned her four games in a row. And I think she didn't pay him after that. because I think she realized, but that wasn't the point. The point was that he was extremely proud of the way he was able to cheat, and he'd mastered a lot of techniques. He was like a pretty good magician. And one thing he would do is, you'd think in the bear off, when you're taking checkers off, that he would take an extra checker off, which he did. But he also had a technique where he would put an extra checker of his opponent's on his opponent's position as he was bearing his own checkers off. So he'd palm, like, let's say he was white and his opponent was black. He would palm a black checker. And as he was taking the white checkers off, his hand would brush against the black checkers. And all of a sudden there'd be another checker there. So Gabby used to tell me things like, he tried to get me to cheat. He said, "Bob, you don't realize what a treasure you have." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, your reputation." I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Well, you don't realize how much it's worth." He said, "Just let me like get you." And he said, like in all these different situations he could get me into, where he would cheat until the final or the semifinal in the tournament, and then I'd be on my own. And I said, no. And he said, "Well, Bob, you don't realize the tragedy of my life." And I said, "What's the tragedy of your life, Gabby?" He said, "Well, I'm a great genius, but I'm too rich. And because I'm so rich, I don't need to cheat anymore. And so I'm a man without a real profession anymore. Like, I can't really display my talents."
That must be tough. He ended up with a very, very lovely wife. Her name was Marcia.
Marcia Clark.
And she was a law student at UCLA when I met her. UCLA is probably 5 miles away from the Cavendish. And later on during the OJ trial, she became famous as Marcia Clark. Has retained a bit of that faith, or that fame. She has lost Gabby along the way, to her credit. Gabby, later, he had a partner for writing named Bruce Roman, Dr. Bruce Roman. Apparently there was an argument and there were guns involved, and Gabby was shot in the head accidentally or not. And so I don't know if Gabby's still alive, but it was turned out that he was likely to be a vegetable for however long he lived. So I have not heard anything about anybody who's seen him alive for 30 years. So I don't know what his condition is, but it's probably not very good.
No, I think the story, the official story is that there was no argument, that they were looking at a gun, or like, you know, how people who like guns have to be loaded and they have to be examined, and somehow the gun went off, and actually there was never any charges filed because the bullet ricocheted from the ceiling into Gabby's head. So it would have made a better story if there had been bad blood between them. And maybe there was, but anyway, that's the official story. And he went back to Israel, and he may still be alive, like not a complete vegetable, but I think never mobile again, like in a wheelchair, and probably, you know, doing the same tricks if he's able to.
I want to go back to last episode. You mentioned that you had a good Stan Thompson story, and I just want to preface this for our listeners that don't know. Stan Thompson was one of the best backgammon players in the 1970s. And he is one of the people that I interviewed for the book Gambling Wizards. And he was one of the original people behind the sports book Pinnacle Sports, which is the best sports book for years, best online sports book. So, yeah, so your Stan Thompson story.
Well, I interviewed Stan Thompson for the video I did about McGrill. And Thompson he's a strange character, but he was extremely adamant and emphatic. "McGrill ruined his life," he said, which is probably true. I mean, most people would agree that he could have done a lot better with his life, but What really annoyed Thompson was that there were these huge pigeons who used to come into the Mayfair back in the early days, and McGreal would ignore them because he was fascinated by some backgammon position, which he was playing with Mike Sankiewicz or something like that. I'm still hearing some fuzz there. But
nothing from my end.
Okay. That was basically it. He really was like, his philosophy, which he, you know, exemplified with this remark, is that, you're a loser if you don't make the money while it's available. And he didn't have any respect for McGreal's sort of love of science and love of research. He just thought that was nonsense. Like, you know, make the money. The fact that McGreal would, be off in the corner, as Thompson said, looking at some, you know, interesting backgammon position when he could have been playing this guy for $1,000 a point was just, an abomination.
Now, another thing about Thompson is Gabby Horowitz gave Thompson credit for teaching him backgammon. The deal was Thompson would teach Gabby how to play the checkers, and Gabby would teach Thompson how to make checkers disappear. So, Thompson wanted to learn all of Gabby's sleight of hand tricks. I never, don't know Thompson. I'm assuming a lot of it was to protect himself when he saw somebody else do it. So I don't know if Thompson ever did it himself, but he wanted to know about him. One of the Gabby tricks that Bob didn't actually mention, sometimes you might roll a 6 and a 3, but the perfect roll is 6 and a 4, so Gabby would just play 6 and 4 and just say, just pick up the checker and move it to the other side of the board and put it down. And you go, well, somebody who plays that fast must be doing it correctly. And so it just happened to be a great roll.
Right.
And so he would do that very well.
Well, he would also snap the dice up, and if you said, wait a minute, you had a 6-3, not a 6-4, he'd go, no, I didn't. It was 6-4.
Yeah. Well, another thing Gabby could do, and my friend Mike Slobodny caught him doing this one time, we were playing at Pips, is the holdout trick.
Pips was in Beverly Hills in the Los Angeles area. It was a higher-end club than the Cavendish.
Yeah, it was like a cafe, bar, disco kind of place, where there at that time all discos had backgammon sets.
Yes.
But do you guys know what the holdout trick is?
No.
I actually have a small book that's devoted to it. It's a magician's trick that you use when you're playing with a dice cup. And what you do is you put only one die in the cup. And one die you hold with your pinky in the hand that's holding the cup so that it's not visible. You shake the dice, and somehow when you shake them, it doesn't sound very different when you shake one die or two. I don't quite know why, but it's true. And then when you roll, you just basically place the die that you've had in your pinky, crooked in your pinky, down on the board, but with a smooth motion. As you're moving your hand to roll the dice, so that one die rolls and the other guy just gets placed, and it's a bit like the slide thing in craps, where one die gets slid and the other guy gets thrown, and we actually caught Gabby doing this. Mike realized what he was doing and grabbed his hand and squeezed it, and the die, you know, popped out of his pinky. But it didn't bother him at all. He was like, yeah, okay, so what? Yeah, right. Now what are you going to do? Yeah. And Gabby was actually not a really good player at all. He thought he was, but he was pretty weak. And if you could ever get him where for a little stretch he wasn't cheating, he was very good value. So that was why Mike didn't quit him. He figured now that he can't cheat, I've got a nice edge.
Gabby had lots of ways to cheating. You really needed to be on your toes when you
played. Yeah, I mean, he actually, I don't know if you talked to Mike Sankowitz about this, but Mike certainly believes, and it's probably true, that Gabby poisoned him.
I thought that was Mike Maxiculli.
No.
In Monte Carlo, that's what you're talking about?
No, it was Sankowitz.
No, I mean,
it was Maxiculli that poisoned him, not Gabby, I thought.
Well, no, it was, no, not that I mean, we have to agree to differ on that. And, you know, I'm sure we're not going to find anybody who knows at this point, but no, it was either Gabby or Gabby's, you know, Gabby had some lackeys. It was probably a lackey of his who, I mean, it's just something he put in Mike's drink.
Yeah, it was scopolamine was the story I heard. You're talking about in Monte Carlo, right?
Yeah.
I heard it was scopolamine, and it was either the semifinals.
Yeah, I mean, Gabby had certain you know, students or acolytes or whatever who he'd seeded into this tournament. And I think that he'd either bet against Mike or had one of his henchmen was playing Mike, or maybe he was playing him. I don't really know all that, but you can ask Sankowitz about that. I'm pretty sure that it was him who, he was the victim.
Right. Hmm. Yeah. He was taken out on a stretcher before the match started.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've always heard Maxiculli was involved, possibly both.
Could be, yeah. I don't know that. I don't know that.
And there's some other people who were alive today who I've also heard name, but that's probably not a good thing to say on the air.
Just a brief aside, there was another notorious cheat who may still be alive, so I'm not going to mention his name, but at the Cavendish in Los Angeles.
And, first name might have been Steve.
Yeah, that might have been his first name. And when my book came out, I did a book signing at a poker tournament in L.A., and this guy came up and started leafing through the book because he wanted to read the Slobotny interview, basically to see if he was in it. And he gave me a name, but it was not the name that I recognized, and it took me a while. I said, "Boy, you look familiar. What's your name?" And he gave me this fake name, and then I realized it was this guy from the Cavendish. And he had changed his name and was now in the poker world. And but he didn't want to buy the book. He just wanted to read through it to see if he had been mentioned.
Well, that guy did cheat me. He cheated me. Gabby never cheated me, but that guy cheated me really badly. It's a great story, but it's too long for this interview. But
it might have related to magnets, and it might have related to double fives, and he played badly at the Cavendish, but he would invite you over to his house to play. And so that's where he would have the magnetic table.
Right, and about a couple of years ago, a friend of mine started a home poker game in L.A., and this guy showed up, and they started talking about me. And this guy, the cheater, was still very proud of the fact that he cheated me 30 years ago. He wasn't ashamed of it at all. And in fact, I've found out that most of these guys who are cheaters, I have another acquaintance who's a pretty famous poker cheater, and he was busted for it eventually. But you know, he admits that, he says, like, in backgammon especially, he says, but in other games too, I'm not as good as these other guys. But that's one thing that I am good at, is thinking of ways to cheat. And, I take a lot of pride in it. So, and he's a pretty, sophisticated, educated person. But I haven't met the cheater yet who's feels bad about what they did or is in any way regretful.
Hmm. All right, let's move on. Somebody who isn't known for cheating, Someone I remember back at the Cavendish was Steve Sachs. I'm about 10 years older than Steve. And by the time he became 21 years of age, I'd been a regular at the Cavendish for 4 years or so. And I could beat him then. But I lost enough money to other players that eventually I had to do what every professional gambler has to do, which is go out and get a job. Now, people who've always had jobs and always had to have jobs doesn't think it's a big deal to go out and have to get a job. But if you're able to support yourself gambling and then lose and have to go out and get a job, this is a traumatic experience. And I came back, played nights and stuff, and by that time, Steve was even with me and quickly became better than me. And I've looked at best players in the world list over the past several years, and you see Steve's names on there. Now, so Steve, at one point in your book, you mentioned he helped you in the rollouts for the 8th point. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah.
So, is he still living in the Los Angeles area?
Yeah, Steve's one of the most prominent American backgammon players, one of the very best. He's a real student of the game, and he's been playing for years. And we used to play at the Persian Club for years and years, too, where Steve had a good thing going. He was a little bit timid playing for money against players who he should never worried about, and was known for making settlements that he shouldn't have made because he wanted to reduce the volatility. But he's done well for himself. I would say he's easily in the top five or three in the United States. Very good player, very strong, and plays a lot of tournaments. And I think he has some good teaching gigs, too, that he's developed of late. So Steve's doing fine, and I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
Well, good. Now, your name figures prominently on the best backgammon players in the world list as well. Exactly which number you are depends on which list we're talking about or what year. Currently, the players at the top of the list are all from Japan. So with Moshi, I guess, at the very top. Without mentioning exactly where you think you belong, do you agree that the Japanese deserve to be at the top of the list?
Japanese and Danes.
Japanese and Danes. They certainly aren't neighbors.
Well, there's a reason for that. By the way, for a number of years, there was a match, Denmark versus the rest of the world. And I played on the rest of the world team four times. But there's a reason why the Japanese and the Danes are the best players. And that is because they're the coolest and the calmest customers out of all the different nationalities. And the truth is that backgammon is a very frustrating game.
Yes.
And if you're at all emotional, you have no shot because you're going to get put on tilt somehow. Like I go on anti-tilt. I'm not a tilter, but I'm an anti-tilter. So when a bunch of horrible events befall me, I go into a shell and I don't take the chances I should because I feel like I'm snake bitten or whatever. But the Japanese and the Danes basically have ice water in their veins. They just, follow logic and they study hard. The Danes have another advantage because they have it's a small country and they have a system of clubs which form backgammon leagues. So if you live in Copenhagen, you belong to the Copenhagen backgammon club, and they there's, they play all the time in your club. It's a, they're cafes actually, but, you know, the cafe sponsors your backgammon club. It's like the dart club or whatever, but they'll go to different, cities throughout Denmark, travel, and they play team matches. And all the best players, even the ones who are really rich and the ones who have made zillions of dollars at sports betting and poker, still play in these matches. So the young players have a tremendous, you know, models to follow and get a tremendous amount of practice against the very best. But you know, the Japanese, Mochi is an especially amazing character. They devote basically, you know, every day of the hour of the day to either their family or backgammon. So Mochi definitely belongs as number one, and Michi is the other guy who's up there, and then
there's a lady up there too, isn't there? Starts with an A.
Akiko. Yeah. And Akiko is perhaps not technically quite as good as those guys, but she's an incredible competitor, and she's won lots of money. She always just if you voice some opinion about a backgammon position, she very politely says in this sort of, you know, Japanese way, like to bet.
Backgammon has all these propositions.
Right.
Where you start a position from some fixed position, and one side or the other, you can have a handicap of 1.5 points or some such. You know, I'll pay you 6 points if you take this position and da da da. And players who play that well get a lot better than the ones who don't. So, yes, Richard?
Is there still a lot of proposition play, given that now the computers are so strong you can just find out which the better side is?
Oh, no. Computers killed a lot of things in backgammon. They killed most money play. They killed proposition play. And they made it really easy for people to write bad books, too. Because, they've had other pernicious effects, too. Because they created a sort of culture where people only look at their mistakes. The way the computer programs are, designed, they always tell you the best move, but when they display a match, for example, they highlight only the mistakes. So let's say you and I play a match and we look at the result of the match afterwards, according to the computer analysis, you're just going to look at your mistakes. And that creates a sort of attitude that's not very easy for beginners to deal with, because you don't really get any reinforcement that you've done anything good. The computer doesn't tell you, wow, that was a great, great move you made. It just passes over it in silence. And in a recent article I wrote, I compared that to chess, where, in chess, there's a vast literature in chess where the games that are annotated, the punctuation marks are not just, oh, that's something wrong, but they're exclamation marks and question marks. The exclamation marks designate really smart plays or really brilliant plays. And in fact, in chess, in tournaments, they used to have what's called a brilliancy prize for the smartest, most daring, fun game that was played in the tournament. But nothing like that exists in backgammon. People are only just concerned with, I made a mistake here or I made a mistake there. But Richard, to get back to your question, no, propositions were this wonderful entertainment and instruction, where if you had a difference of opinion with someone about a doubling decision or a checker play, the two of you could set up a little mini game and play it forever, where first you make your move and then we turn around the board and I make my move. Well, for you make your move, we play the game out, tabulate the result, then we turn the board around, and then I play my move from the position that you played your move, and we tabulate the result. It's a clash of ideas, like in a clash of opinions, that's really fascinating, especially to watch. And propositions used to go on for days and even weeks, where two players would be so opinionated and so sure they were right that neither of them was willing to quit. And the computers destroyed all that, because all you need to do is now, consult bot once, and you know you're on the wrong side and you're just going to quit. So
is there any money to be made in backgammon anymore?
Well, of course. But there's money always to be made in any kind of gambling, because all you need to do is find someone who's worse than you and play them.
But if the pool is so small, it sometimes makes it very difficult to find that person.
Well, yeah, that's the art of it. But the most money that's been made in backgammon comes from people who never even went to a tournament. There was this guy, his name was Harvey Huey in Texas, who owned a chain of hotels. And he probably lost more money than the net worth of, a hotel or two worth of money playing backgammon with another guy at his golf club. Harvey wanted to go to backgammon tournaments because he found out about it, which was a terrible, result for his opponent, who was just had a captive audience. And when he'd go to tournaments, like seven or eight pros would flock around him and they'd play a chouette where they were all divvying him up. But there are people, many, many people in the world who love backgammon. And if you find somebody like that, you can play them for years. And they're usually like, if it's somebody with enough money, they usually don't mind. They're, as long as you're, treat them well, they're happy to lose to you, because the game's just so fascinating. And even the worst player can win, and they can win again and again and again. Streaks can go on for quite a while. You know, I played a guy who was a lawyer in San Francisco area, my point is that there's a lot of self-deception too. Like even if you play someone and you beat them really badly, they can convince themselves that it wasn't that bad at all. There was a lawyer I used to play in Marin County. I lived in Marin County. He's wealthy, and I beat him every time we played, and for significant amounts. And after 5 years, he said to me, "You know, Bob, I think we're like pretty even players." You know, he said, "No, you know a few little tricks, but basically we're at the same level." So there's always, that element of self-deception. And if you're removed from the actual backgammon tournament world, it's completely possible to find people like that who just love the game. And you have to remember too that the Middle East is just like full of millions of backgammon players. They play in Iran and Turkey and Israel and in Jordan and Syria, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, every country in that area, including Georgia and Kazakhstan and, you know, backgammon is the national game in those places. And there are plenty of people with lots of money. I mean, it takes some enterprise to find them. And, you know, I would never suggest that you should hustle. I think that's, you know, unethical. Hustle in the sense of deceive them and about your strength. But a lot of people don't care either. You know, you can tell them I'm a good player and they say, well, I am too. And, I say, no, you're not, but I'm a better player than you. And they say, well, that's what you think. You know, let's play. So it's actually one of the best games to make money at. If you're willing to, you know, you have the enterprise to, you know, beat the bushes a little bit and find people.
I agree. It's one of the best gambling games there is because, as you point out, the bad players think they got unlucky, and there's enough skill that the good player is going to win.
Yeah.
Do you currently make your living playing backgammon, or are you also doing other things?
No, I'm doing some other things, some other gambling ventures. I never made lots of money at backgammon anyway because I'm not.
The hustler type.
Yeah, I'm not ambitious in that way. Like, where Mike Subodny and I, we both, like, were at the Cavendish in the early 80s. He went off, won the Monte Carlo tournament, got an apartment in Monte Carlo, went all over Europe, and, found lots of, you know, those kinds of opportunities where I just stayed at the club because, you know, it was good enough for me that I had, a little game. So I'm not really of the type, you know, few things have fallen my way.
You mentioned that you're involved in other gambling things. Is that anything you can talk about or you'd rather not?
I'd rather not.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Yeah, I almost killed myself a little bit, but I had a sip of water and it went down the wrong tube. I apologize to our listeners for distressing them. I was a bit distressed myself. Before we continue with questions for Bob, this is a good time to take a commercial break, and then we have several more questions for you.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In July, it's a $600,000 Mad Money promotion. All month long, there'll be two casino-wide progressives going on. The major one must hit between $10,000 and $25,000, and anyone playing when it goes off who doesn't get the main award receives $25 in free play. The smaller progressive runs between $1,000 and $2,500. It is geared to hit approximately three times a day. On both progressives, you're eligible if you have your card inserted and have bet at least $1 in the minute prior to the jackpot being hit. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Wheel Poker with Quick Quads. Seven coins per line game, which is one extra for the wheel and one extra for quick quads. The wheel averages 157.5 coins, and you get it every quad and quick quad.
All right, we're talking to Bob Octell. And the World Series of Poker is just beginning here in Las Vegas. And in poker, a high percentage of the winners are guys in their 20s, guys in their 30s. If I look today at the list of the best U.S. players, I know most of them, or remember most of them, and they're all senior citizens. So, do you have any theory as to why poker is a game for the young people, and video poker is a game for the seniors?
You mean backgammon, not video poker.
Backgammon. I'm sorry, did I say video poker? Okay, why is backgammon, the seniors do well in backgammon and not so well in poker?
Well, despite the fact that I've touted backgammon as a great gambling game, and I've insisted that you can make money at it playing money games, there isn't really any money in tournament backgammon. Very little, anyway. And that's the reason that you don't have young studs coming up. There are some in Europe, and there are a few in America, too, but basically, there's not enough money to justify people doing the work. There are probably lots of good players who don't go to tournaments. But, you know, there's not the kind of money, that there is in poker.
I would also add that poker, really, there's a lot of stamina involved. You know, those tournament days can be 12, 14 hours, and younger players are just going to stand up better to those kind of hours.
Yeah, I'm good friends with Dan Harrington.
Uh-huh.
And Dan's retired from poker, basically, and he told me a story. He said, like, I got to the final. He got to the final table a few times and won. Once, I think, in the World Series, or maybe twice, I don't know. But he said, like, this one hand, people are critical of some play I made, you know, some bluff I ran or something like that. He said, like, I was so tired at the final table in this one year that I was trying to bet $60,000, and I had $5,000 chips or $10,000 chips, and I couldn't calculate how many chips it took. So, you know, you're right. Tournament poker takes a tremendous amount of stamina, and it's probably once you're over 30, you're already, you know, have a tough time. Except for Eric Seidel.
Same thing with chess. We have some mutual friends who are very, very strong chess players who decided to try to make a comeback, you know, in the last 10 years. And they went and started playing some chess, and they just found like their clocks would run out because the time it takes to calculate, they just can't do it as quickly as they used to when they were young.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're probably not as... Things don't come as automatically either when you're not immersed in the milieu, you know, and you're not playing every day.
Now, we talked about the Monte Carlo tournament a little bit. Your best finish there, I believe, is second place, which is an impressive accomplishment by any standard. Now, several years ago, this happened. Do you ever think about that finals match, second-guessing any plays you made, which might have made you world champion, or was that just another tournament and some you win, some you lose?
I actually played that's one of my claims to fame, is that I had the lowest error rate of anyone who ever played in a Monte Carlo final, even though I lost the match. So, no, I don't have any regrets about the way I played. Error rate is an interesting concept that occurs in backgammon because there's a bot. Hearing some sound.
As am I, but I'm not moving.
All right. There are programs that basically are almost perfect, and they compare your play to perfect play. And the closer that your play comes to perfect play, the lower your error rate. And in the backgammon world, results don't matter as much now as error rate does. It's how well you, because error rate is a true measure of how well you play. So, in that particular match, I played really well. The other guy didn't play too great. My claim to fame is that, you know, I played at a really low error rate, even though I lost the match. So no, I don't have any regrets about that one.
In backgammon, some players constantly chatter during the game. Some are very quiet. Some spend the whole time complaining about how lucky you are or whatever else. As a player, does your opponent's demeanor affect you much?
It does, but that's a flaw in my, makeup. I must admit that it bothers me. It also bothers me when people talk, like, loud, right 2 feet away from me while I'm trying to think. That's not like chess, where you, even in a tournament among kids, there was, like, pretty much, it was pretty quiet because people are trying to think. In tournament play, people are not allowed to chatter. They're not allowed to complain, really. And you can appeal to the tournament director when that happens. But in money games, it's something you have to put up with. And the most successful money players are the ones who actually enjoy hearing their opponents complaining. And I have a friend like that. It just says, well, that means, that's just music to my ears when the guy complains about his bad luck, and tells me, you know, it's usually a combination where they complain about their luck, but they tell you how lucky you are and how badly you play, even though you're beating them. So, you know, I'm in that sense, I'm not really suited again to making money. Some friends of mine are much better at that. They, everything, you know, goes off their, like water off a duck's back kind of thing.
Changing subjects.
Yeah.
On with chess clocks. They're now used in many tournaments. When I played, they were not used at all. So are the chess clocks used the same way in backgammon tournaments as they are in chess tournaments, or are they different?
Well, it's a little different because there's a delay. And there's a funny story about that. You know, in chess, you might play a match where each person has an hour and a half for 40 moves. As you play, you record the moves. And as a player, you know how many moves you've made, how much time you have to go, and so forth. Backgammon, first of all, is open-ended. You don't record the moves like that. So you'll have a certain amount of time for an entire match. Let's say you're playing a match to 13. Well, that might take 3 games. It might take 2 games. It might take 20 games. You don't really know how much time, it's how many games there are going to be. So you don't really know. You can't really judge with any accuracy how to budget your time. But backgammon also has the feature that chess doesn't have, where you, not a machine, have to produce your own roles. And the traditional way of doing that is to have a dice cup, put 2 dice in the cup, shake the cup, shake, 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 and then roll the dice. That takes a certain amount of time. It can take from 3 or 4 seconds to 10 or 15 seconds. And sometimes when you roll the dice land cocked or not flat on the board, and you have to re-roll, or they land on top of the opponent's checkers, so you have to re-roll them. So that there's a certain amount of time that normally, that nowadays they've realized they have to give you on each roll to produce the roll. So that's called a delay. And usually you have like a 10 second delay for each move. And you might not have all that much time for the entire match. But most of the time, if you produce your dice rolls pretty quickly, you'll still have a few seconds of the delay to think, and then it's only then that your time starts running. Now, what happened when it's when they first started using chess clocks, there is a tournament in Stockholm, Sweden in 2009 that I attended, where Mochy, the number one player in the world, and he was either number one or two or three at that time, was playing a match. But the tournament director, who was a chess player and not really, apparently, hadn't really thought very much about backgammon, had not instituted the delay. So they'd given the players quite a lot of time. It was like 45 minutes each for the entire match. But this turned out to be quite a long match. And it was a 13-point match, and it was a long match in that they played a great number of games. And Mochy started getting short of time, and it got to 11-11. That's called a situation that's called two away. You're 2 points away from your goal, both players. And it's sort of one of the little paradoxes of backgammon is that it doesn't matter whether you double or not at that time. You can't do better than doubling by the math. But anyway, Mochy is one of those players who doesn't always play by the math. He tries to get a little bit of an edge. So he didn't double for about 10 rolls of this game. And when he finally doubled, his opponent immediately passed. And the reason his opponent immediately passed is because he realized that Mochy wasn't physically going to be able to make the moves in time because there was no delay. And now that the score was 12-11 and it was the Crawford game where no doubling is allowed, that would mean Mochy had to play two more games, unless he got a gammon in one of them. And he physically wasn't able to play the moves because he only had like a minute left or something like that. And without a delay, each time he shook the dice, he was using up 5 or 6 seconds. So he lost the match on time. And ever since then, they've been, you know, they've known that you need a delay in backgammon, which you don't in chess. But the clocks are very important because, you know, they prevent players from just taking interminable amounts of time on obvious moves. There's a story that goes back to the 1850s when Paul Morphy was the U.S. chess champion and he went to England to play Howard Staunton, who was the British champion. And Staunton knew that Morphy was better than he was. And so he took as much as 2 or 3 hours on a move. And Morphy actually started to cry at one time, because he was so frustrated. So in chess, they realized they needed clocks and you need backgammon for the same reason. You need clocks in backgammon for the same reason, although you need them with a little nuance, the delay, because otherwise it's not really feasible.
Thank you. Enjoyed listening to you again. We're going to have you on again talking about the second volume of your Ace Point book. I have a physical copy in my possession, but I haven't opened it up yet until after these last two interviews were done. Now, I'm looking forward to reading that book, and we'll get together sometime in the future, and we'll talk to you again.
Great. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You may thank me.
I do. It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you much, Bob.
Very good. Well, go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.